I'm Izzy Judd, and welcome to my podcast, Let's Talk Fertility. This podcast is sponsored by Pregnacare. During my own fertility treatment and pregnancies, I was recommended to take specialist vitamins and minerals to support my nutritional needs. There are many benefits to taking these supplements, and they also made me feel like I was taking a proactive approach to prepare myself and my body as best I could. Pregnacare Conception and Wellman Conception vitamin and mineral supplements provide advanced nutritional support for men and women trying for a baby, including zinc, vitamin D, and the exact levels of folic acid recommended for women by the UK Department of Health. Pregnacare, expert nutritional care while trying for a baby. To find out more, visit www.pregnacare.com. On today's episode, I wanted to give listeners an insight and an explanation about what IVF actually is, and for those already on their own fertility road, a clear understanding of what to expect. I also hope this podcast might give friends and family a better understanding about what is involved when going through the process of IVF. I have chosen to speak to a panel of experts from the Herts and Essex Fertility Centre, simply because this is where Harry and I had our own fertility treatment. The centre was founded in 1989 by Michael Amoy, and ever since their dedicated team has helped to create thousands of happy new families by delivering over 6,000 babies, one of which I'm proud to say is my daughter, Lola. So welcome to David Ogotu, Medical Director and Consultant Gynaecologist, Debbie Evans, Director of Clinical Services and Senior Nurse, and Dr. Lucy Richardson, Laboratory Director and Embryologist. Lucy was the embryologist who took care of our frozen embryo, which resulted in the birth of our daughter, Lola. So thank you, David, Debbie and Lucy. It's a pleasure to have the chance to talk to you all today.
Thank you, Izzy.
Thank you, Izzy.
So, yeah, I basically, from the podcast today, what I would really love to do is give a very informative and, you know, real explanation of what IVF actually is, because I know before I'd even begun, I had absolutely no idea what those three letters meant. So if we just start with the basics, David, could you explain what IVF is and what it actually stands for?
Yeah, thanks, Izzy. So IVF stands for in vitro fertilization, which in plain English is fertilizing eggs with sperm outside the body, creating embryos, which are the beginnings of a baby, and then transferring them back into a woman to carry the pregnancy.
So when you are struggling to become pregnant, how long should you wait before consulting a doctor or fertility expert?
Yes, so it will depend on several factors, but ideally we'd expect that out of 100 couples who are trying to get pregnant, especially where the woman is less than 40 years of age, at the end of 1 year, 80 would have conceived spontaneously. And by the end of 2 years, about 90 would have conceived spontaneously. So if at the end of 1 year, a couple have not conceived, despite not using contraception and having regular unprotected sexual intercourse, then they should seek fertility advice and preferably investigations to assess why they're not getting pregnant. Now, for those women who are those couples where the woman is more than 36 years of age, or who have other gynecological conditions like endometriosis or fibroids, or not ovulating because of PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, then it would make sense for them to seek advice sooner than the 1 year. So maybe 4 to 6 months of trying.
And would your GP be the first place you should go to?
Yes, so the GP should be the first place to go to for their initial investigations, because the NHS provides the basic tests for assessment. Now, where it takes too long to get the appointments, some couples, especially if they are older or if they've got a genuine gynecological condition that and they're aware that they would need help sooner, then they could self-refer to a fertility clinic, but the NHS offers the initial investigation, so it would be worth exploring that first.
Yeah. Yes. And what would you say the main causes of infertility are?
Out of 100 couples who are having difficulty getting pregnant, would find that 30 out of 100 are having difficulty because of a problem with ovulation or with eggs. 30 would be due to tubes either being blocked or not functioning as they should, and 30 would be due to male factor, sperm-related, and 10 of them would be due to a combination. So it's quite evenly spread in terms of male factor or as well as female factor being the cause. So the advice would be that if a couple were having difficulty getting pregnant, not to concentrate on only the sperm side being investigated or the woman being investigated, but to investigate both at the same time, because there's almost a 50-50 likelihood that it will be either male-related or female-related or a combination of the two.
And that's so interesting, because you would make the assumption that it would be a female factor. So the fact that it's actually quite evenly spread, I suppose, is quite surprising. And I suppose as well, I guess people might wonder, does IVF lead to twins or multiple births?
Yes, so IVF could potentially lead to twins or multiple births. And we've been very lucky in the UK that this is a recognized risk, and clinics are advised and encouraged to practice responsible medicine to minimize the risk of the probability of having twins or multiple births. Now, most people would assume that having twins is a perfect end, which is, you know, having two babies to carry at the same time. But for a couple having fertility treatment or conceiving naturally, their best chances of taking home a live, healthy baby are if they're carrying one as opposed to two babies. So with IVF treatments, we would be managing them and deciding on the number of embryos to be put back in based on what's most likely to get them pregnant, but at the same time minimizing the chances of them getting twins or triplets.
Has that always been the case with IVF, or is that a regulation that has changed in recent years? Because more commonly you would have, you know, seen more multiple births.
Yes, so it's true that the number of multiple births we're seeing all over the world has increased significantly and over the last 15, 20 years, and that is mainly because of IVF, where we're putting more than one embryo back in, or any other stimulation treatments where women are being superovulated to release more than one egg. But at the inception of IVF treatments, the success rates were very low, and for that reason, it was common practice to transfer 2-3, sometimes even up to 6 embryos to optimize the chances of success. But over time, the success rates have improved significantly, to the point where for women under 40, we've got very good confidence that if we're transferring one top quality embryo back in, we're not decreasing the chances of getting pregnant. We're actually giving them a decent chance of getting pregnant, but minimizing the risk of multiple births, because the multiple births come with their problems. There's a higher risk of miscarriage with multiple births. The twins or triplets are in many cases born prematurely, and if they're born too prematurely, they may either not survive or they potentially may survive with disability. So we manage the treatments to minimize the chances that they end up with twins.
And Debbie, what fertility treatments do you offer at Hearts in Essex?
Well, we are a standalone, fully fledged fertility centre, and we offer a whole array of fertility treatments, right through from ovulation induction, right through to the upper end of surrogacy, the more complicated sides of fertility.
And when you first go to a clinic, how important is it to consider the success rates, and where can you find that information?
Of course, success is very important, but it's not the only parameter you should look at when you're looking for a clinic. It needs to be that clinic where you're going to feel really comfortable in, you're going to be part of the team that's there. They're going to look after you, nurture you through your treatment. For us at Hearts in Essex, that's much more important. But success is paramount to our couples that are coming through our clinic, and you can find that information where it is verified on our HFEA website. So as a clinic, we're duty-bound to produce our success rates in a way that patients can understand, and then that is corroborated and verified at the HFEA, so they know that clinics aren't making up their success rates.
So when a patient comes to the centre for the first time, what should they expect from their initial consultation?
So every clinic will be slightly different, but at Hearts and Essex, one of our nurses will spend a little bit of time, 20 minutes to half an hour, with the patient, making them feel comfortable, taking some baseline observations, taking a very basic history. And then we ask our gentlemen, if there is a gentleman partner, to produce a sperm sample on that day. And then once we've got all that information, we then take them in to see the consultant. They will, of course, have to fill out a few consent forms. There are a whole array of consent forms when you come into a fertility setting. But the first ones would be a welfare of the child assessment and a consent to disclosure. So unlike any other forms of medicine, we require your consent to discuss your fertility treatment with either your GP or gynaecologist or urologist. So you would need to sign those forms. So that nurse will spend time explaining those forms and what that means before they actually sign them.
And I understand that depending on the fertility issue, the protocol can differ. But are you able to give an example of, you know, what to expect from your first round of IVF?
Yeah, so there are lots of different types of cycles, and everyone's going to be different. So based on your assessment with the consultant will be what type of treatment. But if I talk about somebody that's got generally a 28-day cycle, what it might mean to them and the commitment that they might need to make once they embark on an IVF round. So they'll start around about day 21 of one cycle, and they'll start taking their first drug, and they'll have their period, their bleed, about a week later, and then we scan them to see that that first drug has actually worked. And that first drug downregulates, it stops what naturally normally happens. So it puts them into a little mini menopause. And then once everything's okay and we've seen that the ovaries are nice and quiet and the lining is nice and thin, then we'll start on the stimulation drugs. The stimulation drugs take about 2 weeks. So at that point, the ladies will be taking approximately 2 injections every day. And in that period, we'll be scanning them 2, 3, sometimes 4 times, depending on their response. Then we get to a point where we've got nice big ovaries with some nice developing follicles. And then we'll arrange a time, trigger the ovulation for them to come in for egg collection, which is removed and with sedation through ultrasound-guided needles. And then your embryos will start to grow. And I'm sure you'll be talking to Lucy a bit later on about the embryo development. Then they can go back on either day 2, day 3 or day 5. So that whole process from starting the first injection right through until embryo transfer is about 6 weeks.
So what are the medications that you're speaking about that are used for IVF? And also, how do these affect you emotionally and physically?
So they're hormones. And we all know as ladies how our hormones affect us. So we do coach our patients right from the very beginning about the nature of the medication they're going to be taking. I spoke about the first drug, which is a down-regulation drug, and it's going to put them into menopause. So they will have those night sweats and those mood swings and bloatedness, feeling out of sorts, really. So as long as they're guided, they understand the type. Some people get everything, some people get nothing at all. But we also include the partners because they need to be wary of the types of symptoms. And then the gonadotrophins, the stimulation drugs, are the ones that are stimulating those ovaries. So again, we encourage them what they need to be doing, understanding how those drugs are going to affect them individually throughout the cycle.
And I know, obviously, Debbie, from personal experience, that if I had any concerns throughout that time, I could always pick up the phone and speak to a nurse.
Always.
Because, you know, suddenly you're giving yourself these injections and you do, well, I certainly did respond. You know, I had some negative effects. Some of the medication I took, I was fine with, but it was so important to be able to have that nurse to talk to.
Yeah.
And also, I think many women might actually be quite frightened to take injections. You must see patients that are actually quite fearful because it's, you know, a needle.
At our clinic, I know we purposely spend an awful lot of time before you start your cycle. Once we've decided what type of cycle you're going to be embarking on, you'll sit with one of our specialist nurses and spend at least an hour not only going through your consent forms, but the treatment itself, the commitment you need to make, the drugs you're going to be taking, how to take them, what to expect from them. But all of our paperwork shows the patients that at any point in their cycle, they have access to us, and that includes out of hours, because one of my nurses will always have the on-call phone, and we have that 7 days a week, 365 days a year, because it is important that you have got somebody in the line. You've messed up your drug, you've taken it wrong, or you've spilt it, help, what do I do?
What do I do? Yeah.
It's really important.
And how many injections does a patient give themselves during a round of IVF? I mean, I know it'll differ depending on, you know, what protocol, et cetera, but on average?
On average, particularly on a lung protocol, you're going to probably be taking up to about 30 injections in that IVF cycle. That's an awful lot to expect anybody to take. There's never, ever given themselves an injection before.
And I've often wondered where everybody does the injections, you know, if you're continuing to work. I mean, I talked about when I gave myself an injection in a portaloo at one of Harry's gigs, you know, and often you're doing it in silence, and it's so much emotion need to take on. So to know you've got that nurse on the end of the phone,
no, it's really important.
It's so important. Yeah. And talking about that, I mean, do you recommend taking any time off work?
Everybody's different, and I won't say to a patient that you need to take 2 weeks off work to get yourself through this, but, you know, we do require that you need to attend the clinic for 3-4 scans, and then for egg collection and then embryo transfer. That's quite a lot of time, and even if you've got another child, you know, you're trying to juggle all hands. It's up to the individual patient, but, you know, I won't say that you have to take time off work, but a lot of people do, particularly the time after the embryo transfer.
So if we go back to kind of the stimulation phase, how often do you scan a patient and what are you looking for exactly in those scans?
Okay, so in those scans, in the first phase, we want to see that everything's gone all nice and quiet before we can even think about starting the stimulation drugs. But the important part is that stimulation. And what we're looking for are those scans is that you're responding to the drugs that we're giving you. Naturally, normally, you'll have a cohort of what we call antral follicles in your ovary. One of those becomes the dominant follicle and produces the egg. What we hope for in IVF is that more of that small cohort of antral follicles will respond to our medication and we'll all produce an egg. But of course, we won't know that until we put that needle in and remove the fluid and hopefully eggs come through. But we know that by every scan, we're seeing development and growth. We want to see maturity in those follicles.
Do the medications that we take during IVF have any long-term side effects?
So just as Debbie has mentioned, the hormones we're using for the IVF process are naturally occurring hormones normally. So we're trying to mimic or manipulate what would occur in a woman's menstrual cycle. So to have control of the process and to ensure that we don't lose eggs or to ensure that women, patients don't ovulate behind our backs during the process, we would be giving them a down-regulation injection, which creates a temporary menopause-like state. And that is effective for the duration when they're taking it. So as soon as they stop taking the medication, the effect of it wears off, but it provides some control. In terms of the stimulation, of course, if you can imagine in a natural cycle, you only have one follicle developing. With a stimulation cycle, it could be 10, 15, 20 follicles developing. So there may be some pressure symptoms in the pelvis because of an enlarged ovary. But again, this would dissipate once the eggs are collected. When IVF developed, one of the concerns we had was, could this hormonal treatment have a long-term health effect in terms of things like inducing early menopause or increase the risk of cancers. And patients having fertility treatment throughout the world, and especially in Europe and the US, have been monitored to assess whether there's an increase in incidence of premature ovarian failure or ovarian cancers, and there isn't an increase. There's no increase in risk compared to those who've never had fertility treatment. So we're very confident that the treatment we provide is not putting people at risk of problems.
So once we've gone through, obviously, the stimulation phase, we hope to get to egg collection, which was one of the things I was actually most terrified about. Is it painful? And what can a patient expect from the procedure and also sedation?
Yes. So to collect the eggs are collected under transvaginal ultrasound guidance with a needle that goes into the ovaries to collect the eggs. So that is potentially a painful procedure if not given some form of anaesthetic. There are three main different ways in which eggs are collected anesthesia-wise, and that is either through local anesthetic, light sedation or a deep sedation. The least form of anesthetic that offers the best pain relief is with the deep sedation. So at our clinic at Hearts and Essex, we use deep sedation for the egg collection because with that, the patient is completely asleep and there is no discomfort from it. But there are other clinics that would prefer to use a lighter sedation or local anesthetic. Some patients would prefer and actually request for a local anesthetic, and it's possible to collect eggs through that, but there would be some degree of discomfort with that. But for the vast majority of patients who would be using a deep sedation, there should be no discomfort during the procedure.
I remember waking up from the procedure and feeling kind of very intense period pains, but that seemed to be sorted very quickly by the lovely nurse that was by my side, Debbie. So is that something that, you obviously manage?
We're very honed in on that, you know, once you wake up, that's comfort is our main priority, and we'll be scoring you out of level 1 to 10 about what your pain is feeling like. And as much as you might be a bit woozy, you're very quick to tell us if you've got pain. So, yeah. And we'll respond. We'll use hot heated pads. They're very effective.
Yeah.
But we do give you pain relief medication whilst you're in theatre before we wake you up. And, of course, we can give you top-up drugs afterwards in recovery.
Yeah, and a hand to
And hold. To hold, as always.
Yeah, and because I woke up in floods of tears.
I was just going to say, very emotional as well. That journey is, you know, you're putting your faith in us now, and here you are, your beautiful eggs have been collected, your sperm is there, you now need
you're
us to do that.
You're at the most vulnerable, yeah. Really. You're at your most vulnerable.
You're out of control.
That's it.
You have no control. You're relying on us to support and help you.
So how many eggs do you hope to collect from egg collection? And also, can you explain what hyperstimulation means?
David?
Yes, so the number of eggs we would collect would depend on the number of eggs in reserve. So for those who have a very low egg reserve, for example, if they're recruiting only 5 eggs, the maximum number of eggs would expect to collect is the 5 they've recruited, which we hopefully have stimulated. But for those with a very high egg reserve who have the potential to produce, you know, 20, 30 eggs, then we're very, very cautious not to stimulate to get that many eggs because that could get them quite unwell. So the optimum egg numbers for success is usually somewhere between 8 to 12 eggs. So we'd be aiming to get that sort of egg. So for those with a low egg reserve, a higher dose of stimulation to optimize the number we get. But for those with a normal or a very high egg reserve, a lower dose so that not all of those eggs develop. Because if all of those develop and you collect too many eggs, then they may have significant discomfort, pain, nausea, vomiting from something called hyperstimulation.
But you would very quickly know what those signs are. Obviously, you're taught through those.
Yes, so we'd be able to tell who is at risk of hyperstimulation even before we start the stimulation. So the cycle is managed in a way that minimizes the risk of hyperstimulation. But some ovaries are so sensitive that despite our best efforts, they may still produce too many eggs.
Okay, so going through the IVF cycle, we've done egg collection. So this is where Lucy, our lovely embryologist, can join the conversation. And also the men can join the conversation, because obviously up to now it's been very much about what the woman is going through. So what can the man expect from the process of giving a sperm sample?
So before we see our chaps, they do have a little bit of homework, and that's that they need to make sure their abstinence period is right. So your abstinence is the length of time since your last ejaculation. So before we see a chap, either for analysis or for preparation for treatment, we need to ask them to have abstained for between 2 and 5 days ahead of their appointment. If they've ejaculated too recently, we can find that will have effects on their sperm. And similarly, if they've had a long period since their last ejaculation, again, that will affect what we're seeing in the laboratory. So to optimise their sample, somewhere between 2 and 5 days, 3 is my favourite number. So I would always recommend 3 days before they produce a sample, they produce a sample at home, and then nothing again until their day of treatment. At Hearts and Essex, our chaps will be shown into a private room by one of the nursing team, where they'll be able to produce their sample in quiet, in comfortable conditions. One of the laboratory team will be on the sperm, as it were. We have a little doorbell, so they'll press the bell, let us know they've finished their sample, we'll come around, we'll collect the sample from them, and then we'll either analyse the sample, if it's perhaps in conjunction with an appointment with the doctor, or we'll prepare the sperm sample in readiness for mixing with the eggs the afternoon after we've recovered the eggs.
Yeah, because I was going to ask how long it is before you find out if any of the embryos have fertilised.
So when we collect our eggs, we have to time the collection of the eggs according to the last injection that the lady's taken. So if she has her last injection at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night, we'll be collecting her eggs at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning. Everything we do in the laboratory is guided by times. So in the afternoon of the lady's egg collection, we will then mix the sperm and eggs, and then we check for signs of fertilisation 16 to 18 hours later. So the following morning, we would then be able to assess how many of those eggs have fertilised.
And I think when you are going through IVF, you can become quite focused on the grading of an embryo. Can you explain what that means and what that process is?
So on a daily basis, the embryology team are looking at the embryos and monitoring how they develop. Well, now, we know embryos develop in a very stereotypical pattern. So 2 days after the egg collection, we're looking for them to have divided, to have somewhere between 2, 3 and 4 cells. 3 days after collection, again, we're looking for somewhere between 6, 7 and 8 cells. And as they're developing, we're looking for their quality. So we look at the shape of the cells as they divide, whether there's any fragmentation. So sometimes when an embryo divides, it might be a little bit uneven. Some of the cells may be excluded. We combine that information with the rates at which they're dividing. So if I'm to look at some embryos on day 2, where I'm expecting between 2, 3 and 4 cells, if one of the embryos is still at the single cell stage and hasn't divided, that's showing me already this embryo is probably not the most likely to give rise to a pregnancy. Similarly, if I see an embryo that has 8 cells when I'm looking for 2, 3 or 4, again, that's showing me that that embryo isn't developing as we would normally expect, and we'll monitor those embryos slightly separately. But we gather cumulative information that gives us an understanding as to the embryo's potential to give rise to a pregnancy.
And what are the chances of success from a day 2 or 3 transfer versus a day 5 transfer? And why would you decide to transfer early?
So with the evolution of techniques in the laboratory, we've learned that we can grow embryos for longer successfully in the laboratory. Now, historically, because our methods in the lab weren't quite so robust, we would be looking at transferring perhaps more embryos at an earlier stage. But now we know that we can culture them for longer in the laboratory, the embryologist will get much more information as to the potential of each embryo. Now, for some ladies, perhaps they have smaller numbers. The embryos have self-selected at an earlier stage. So the benefits of keeping embryos longer in the lab is purely for selection purposes. If it's very clear on day 2, I look down the microscope and I've got one that's clearly waving at me, standing out above from the rest, I know that that's the embryo that's going to be transferred. So keeping it longer is not going to change that decision as to which one I'm picking. So we have absolutely amazing incubators in the lab, but an embryo is supposed to be in the uterus. So it's a little bit of a balance between how long we keep it, the embryos in the lab for selection purposes, and actually bringing the patient in and getting that embryo back where it needs to be. There's nothing we can do in the lab to improve an embryo's quality, but keeping it will give us more information that helps assess its potential.
Because one of the things I found most comforting about Hearts in Essex was the fact that after egg collection, I would receive a phone call each morning from the embryologist. So, Lucy, obviously, as an embryologist, you must feel quite a lot of pressure. And at times, it must be hard to separate yourself emotionally.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very, very lucky that my favourite thing in the world happens to be my job. And I'm absolutely enthralled by the whole subject, and it means the world to me. But you do at times have to try and take a little bit of a step back. You do feel pressure, you do feel responsible. I mean, I was the embryologist that did the ICSI that led to your frozen embryos. So that is quite a strange thing to think about. And I think if you did overthink it, you'd probably be quite frightened of what you were doing. pretty much, you know, there isn't a day that I don't take some aspect of work home. If I've had a particularly difficult ICSI or a particularly challenging case, the next morning, come on, I need to know, how did they do? And that's really important for us, is having that connection with the patients as well, and to be able to deliver the good news, but also, really importantly, to be able to deliver the bad news, and to be there for the patients if we're not giving them good news.
Absolutely. Could you just explain what ICSI is versus IVF mm-hmm. for people that might not understand that?
So when we are dealing with eggs and sperm in the lab, we need to work out which is the best way to make them meet. That largely depends on the sperm parameters. So how many sperm we have, how well the sperm are swimming, and also the shape of the sperm. Now, for some couples, if everything's nice and normal on paper, we'll opt for in vitro fertilisation. So with this technique, we recover the eggs, we recover the sperm, we purify a set number of sperm, we pop them into a dish with the eggs and put them back into the incubator. The idea is overnight they'll be able to swim and naturally fertilise those eggs. For some couples, we would recommend the ICSI procedure. Now, ICSI is intracytoplasmic sperm injection, which is a bit of a mouthful, so we just call it ICSI. And that's where the embryologist individually injects sperm into the eggs. Now, the benefit of this approach is we can guarantee that sperm and egg meet. Unfortunately, what we can't guarantee is that the egg and sperm then interact in the correct way to achieve fertilisation. But for many, many of our couples, it's a really, really useful technique in the lab to make sure that sperm and egg meet.
And what an amazing training you must have to be able to give that procedure. Wow. And at that point, we'll just take a pause before we continue and talk about transfer. So, David, what can a patient expect from the embryo transfer procedure?
So for the embryo transfer, the selected embryos will be transferred through the neck of the womb, which is the cervix, into the uterus. And for the vast majority of couples, our women, we don't need anesthetic for this. So they will be awake during the procedure. They would have a speculum examination similar to when one has a smear test to be able to see the neck of the womb. And the selected embryo would be transferred with a narrow plastic catheter similar to a straw, but very soft catheter, using ultrasound to deposit the embryo or embryos into the cavity of the womb.
And Debbie, what sort of environment do you like to create? Because obviously, although there is a very scientific and medical operation happening, it's also quite a moment for a couple. Yeah. So how do you prepare?
Izzy, you're absolutely correct. You've spent the last 3-4 weeks getting ready for this moment. This is your special time. So we ask you if you want to bring any particular music. The lighting in our theatre and lab environments is very low and moody anyway. So that's encouraging. We encourage your partner to come in with you. You see your embryos on screen before they come, so you get to know what's happening. And then when you're ready, we finally then will, as David said, insert the speculum. But you're there as a couple together with us supporting you.
I remember after transfer, I didn't really want to get off the bed or actually move. but how soon after can you actually leave the centre? And what recommendations do you give to patients about lifestyle during the 2-week wait? And are there any activities?
There's that million-dollar question. Yes. So yes, you can pretty much get up straight away after your embryo transfer. But for comfort's sake and for reassurance for you generally lie around for about 15 minutes and then you can get up and get dressed and you can go home. Activity-wise, for those next 2 weeks until you're doing that pregnancy, we try to get you to be as normal as possible. As hard as that is, just go about your normal daily routines. We ask you to avoid the gym, as you know, if you used to go into the gym, that's absolutely fine. We have aerobic instructors, but just avoid abdominal type stuff. We ask you to avoid heavily scented aromatherapy type oils, because some of those can be harmful to early pregnancy. So in those first few weeks, they're the sort of things we ask you to avoid. But pretty much just go about your actual normal daily living.
And if you are worried, you just call the nurse.
And always call us. Yes.
I called the nurse many times. So David, how is it best to manage expectation for success during a round of IVF?
Yes, so what I advise my patients would be always to look at IVF as a marathon, not as a sprint. which is that some would be lucky to get pregnant the first time round, but for some it may take more than one go before they get there. But it is a process whereby the more chances we give ourselves at getting pregnant, the higher the chance that we fall pregnant. So if it's possible to, the best thing is to look at it as a process that may take more than one go to work. We learn lots from every cycle. There's things we can tweak with from one cycle to another to optimize the chance of success. But unfortunately for some, because of age or the number of eggs they've got, we do get to a point where we would be advising them that it's not worth continuing with the same path because the likelihood of success is very low. Almost always it is because of the age of the eggs, especially by the time we get to 45, 46, the odds of success at that age using our own eggs is very low.
So managing expectation is obviously very important.
Yeah. So
at this point, the patients, obviously, we go home and it's the 2-week wait, which is incredibly difficult. What advice do you give to patients to help them through those 2 weeks wait? And also, the first cycle I did a pregnancy test, but the second time I did a blood test. Mm-hmm. So what's your advice about when to test, how to test, and how to manage
those? 2-week wait is a difficult time. And as I said, just go about your normal daily living as much as you possibly can. Use the support that's there. And we do regularly get patients that call us most days because they're, this is happening, I'm feeling this. You just need that 2 minutes of reassurance and then you're better for the rest of the day. Pregnancy test, you would have done a urine test at home with your fresh cycle because we are happy with the tests that are out there.
And for what day?
On day, so 14 days after your egg collection. So if you think about the egg collection as ovulation day, 14 days later, you either expect your period or you don't.
Lucy, can you explain what a frozen embryo transfer is and the chances of success versus a fresh cycle?
Mm-hmm. So the most important thing is obviously finding the optimal embryo for transfer. But in some cases, we will have surplus good quality embryos left over. Generally, at Hearts and Essex, we are only freezing embryos at the blastocyst stage. So that's either day 5 or day 6 in their development. We use a fast freezing technique called vitrification. And in our hands, currently 98% of embryos do survive the freezing and the thawing process. But the key is we have to be very strict about what we freeze. I'm not going to freeze something if I know, hand on heart, it doesn't have the structures that are needed for pregnancy, or it's not likely to survive that freeze-thaw process. So good quality blastocysts can be vitrified or frozen. If you were to come then back for a frozen embryo replacement, it's somewhat easier on the woman because we're not stimulating any ovaries. We don't need to develop any eggs. So the medication is reduced. There is no stimulatory phase. There is no egg collection. There may be some medication ahead of that cycle just to make sure that we've got the optimum uterine environment. So your uterus is looking nice and ready for embryos to go back. And then in the laboratory, we'll thaw the embryos out. Again, give you a call, let you know what the embryo survival is like, and then bring you back and perform the embryo transfer for you as we would have done for a fresh cycle.
So we talked about male factor infertility earlier. And what advice do you give to patients about how to improve sperm quality?
Lifestyle has a massive, massive impact on fertility, both for us girls and guys, but the difference between the guys and the girls is us ladies, we're born with the number of eggs we're born with. Every time we have a cycle, that's more of our stock of eggs gone, and there's nothing we can do about it. However, chaps, they're constantly renewing their source of sperm. So when a chap produces a sperm sample, it formed in his body 3 months earlier. So if 3 months ago it was Big John's stag do and it was a rather heavy weekend, that will have an impact on their sperm. Similarly, if they've been unwell, if they've had a nasty bout of the flu, again, it can impact upon their sperm quality. So take a real long, hard look at and realistic look at lifestyle can make a huge difference. I've seen remarkable improvements in sperm quality just by abstaining from the things that we know are bad for us. So smoking, drinking, recreational drugs, but even prescription medication. The testicles are outside the body because sperm production happens at cooler body than core body temperature. So if you sit at home with your laptop on your lap, you're heating up your testicles, it's going to affect your sperm. So lifestyle can have a massive, massive impact on sperm quality.
So Debbie, when we're talking about lifestyle and also the emotional sides of IVF, what kind of advice and support do you offer?
Yeah, we talk about getting yourself fit for fertility, and that's not about taking hundreds of pounds of wacky medication to improve fertility. It's about getting your lifestyle right. And that doesn't just include the physical, that includes the emotional. As you well know, it's a rocky, rocky road, the fertility road, with huge ups and downs. You need to be emotionally stable. You need to be at that right phase where you're ready to embark on what that treatment is going to do to you as a couple and to friends, etc. around you. So you need to be ready for that.
I mean, being such a personal and emotional subject, how do you make sure that the language you use when speaking to patients is sensitive?
I make sure when I'm sitting in front of a couple that they understand what I'm saying to them. We have, as nurses and professionals with infertility, we have to be able to talk about very emotional circumstances. About, you know, when David's seeing a patient in consultation, he needs to talk about how many times they have an intercourse. That's very, very, you know, to be able to sit and speak to a couple in that way. We need to be able to be frank and honest and encourage the patients to speak back to us and let us know what they're doing.
I just wondered what impact you actually believe that stress has on fertility and the chances of success during IVF, because obviously it is an incredibly stressful time and to relax is very difficult.
And unlike lots of forms of medicine, we're very clued up in the fertility sector. And as much as it is a very medical laboratory environment, the stress factor on our patients is huge. So we do encourage alternative medicines. We do encourage relaxation. Mindfulness now is really strong. We talk about acupuncture, hypnotherapy.
David, Debbie mentioned then about having difficult conversations with patients. I just wondered how difficult it is for you medically as well to give a diagnosis of unexplained infertility.
Yes, it is difficult because what unexplained infertility means is that the tests available to us in 2018 cannot explain why that couple are not getting pregnant. And looking at how long they've been trying to get pregnant, they've had all these tests that are normal, can be frustrating because they would like an answer. But from where I'm sitting, it is usually a positive thing as well, because we've not found as anything that is preventing them from getting pregnant. And we know that up to 30-40% of couples with unexplained infertility, if they carried on trying to get pregnant for another 6 months, would conceive naturally. So you'd be able to reassure them that we cannot explain why you're not falling pregnant. You've been trying a very long time, in which case you may need fertility treatment. Or if you've not been trying for a very long time, you may wish to try naturally, especially if they're still younger, because there is still a good chance that they would fall pregnant. But even when they need fertility treatment, you'd always still warn them that if they're not planning to have any more children after their successful fertility treatments, they still have to consider using contraception, because unexplained infertility means they could still get pregnant naturally, and we see that every day.
From a personal level, it must be a difficult diagnosis, though, because you almost want a reason to be given to you. I just wondered what you perhaps feel, Debbie, about the connection between mind and body when it comes to making babies.
Very much so. As I said, you know, to get yourself in that right position to get through the treatment itself is tough. You know, it's one of the most natural things for couples to do. You get together, you make love, you have a baby. That's very difficult when you have to present at a very clinical fertility clinic. When you walk into Hearts and Essex, we try and make the first initial steps through the door an environment that's going to be pleasing and encouraging and get you in. But it is a very, very difficult situation to be in. Couples generally do not want to be, and they've already been on a rocky roller coaster before they've walked through the fertility door. They may have had 1 or 2 years of trying for a baby. They're already emotionally unstable. So it's my job and the rest of our team to support and comfort those patients before they've even started to think about what treatment they might need.
And having IVF is still incredibly magical. You know, I've always said that, and the atmosphere that was created, the people that were around me. You know, Lucy, I remember seeing you at the day of embryo transfer, and you know, and obviously Debbie and David, I couldn't be more grateful to you that, you know, I now have my daughter. But, you know, the first IVF baby, Louise Brown, celebrated her 40th birthday earlier this year. And it's quite amazing to think that IVF is still so young. How can we continue to make research possible for this miracle science, David?
Yes, research, of course, needs money. And we hope that there would be lots more funding, either from charitable organizations or from the state towards fertility treatment. The science is evolving very, very fast. The success rates are increasing dramatically, and we're getting better and better at it. But of course, it will take lots of years to get us towards the high success rates that we aim for. Because for every patient that walks through the door, we aim and hope that we give them a 100% success rate. We're not there yet, but the science is evolving very, very fast. And I'm pretty confident that within our lifetime, we would get to the point where, you know, we would be able to hopefully be doubling the successes we have at the moment.
In hindsight, I really wish that I had donated my eggs for research at the stage before they were fertilised. And that's just something I just want to say. At the time, I hadn't really given it much thought because I was so focused on my own experience. But I do, yeah, in hindsight, I know all the information was given to me, and I know it's very, very difficult. But I just wanted to say that it is worth considering, because if we want it to develop, then obviously you need the tools to be able to. Right, so I just finish all my podcasts with just a couple of questions, which I just wanted to ask you. I wondered, Debbie, what do you think parents should teach their children about fertility?
Everything. And I've gone into my daughter's school. She cringed in year 7, and I was asked to go into her biology lesson and talk about IVF. Her teacher discovered that I was an IVF fertility specialist. So I did, Maggie, sat in the corner of the room thinking, oh my God, Mum's just going to talk about sex. But I didn't. I spoke about it in a very emotional way. And I've been invited back 3 times to that school to speak to them. I think that's probably the right sort of age that we should be talking about it. But now that IVF is out there, you should be speaking to your children about it, particularly if they've been born as a result of IVF. They're special.
Oh. Lucy, what do you do for yourself after a long day in such an important and, I imagine, emotionally demanding job?
I think it's brings home when you go home to your own family, and I spend time with my loved ones, my nieces and nephews, just how precious family is, and spending that time with the people that I love, and that also the people that support me, because without the support of my loved ones and my family, I couldn't do what I do. So, yeah, family is everything.
And Hearts in Essex, do you have a mantra for staff and patients, something that you feel you want to pass on?
Well, I think and that's me as the clinic manager, and I'm very focused on it. And I say, look after your staff, then watch them look after the patients.
Oh, that's lovely.
And for me, that we do look after them.
Well, I have to say, you know, I owe an awful lot to Hearts in Essex, and when I wanted to bring a team of experts, I couldn't have, you know, thought of a better place to bring us into a room and talk. And thank you so much for giving people. I'm sure it will be very insightful and very helpful. Just to finish, you mentioned you do a bit of mindfulness.
Yes.
So there's just an exercise I wanted to give to the staff and the patients. Really simple little exercise, but you mentioned earlier about a lot of control that, you know, we try and hold on to, and this is really simply called let go. And it's just as you breathe in, you say the word let, and as you breathe out, you say go. And it might just help people just to release a bit of that tension.